stacked on end against one wall. Hundreds of drill bits, small tools, and wooden templates were arranged neatly on wall-mounted pegboard panels. He turned, and when he saw me, he shut down the lathe. "Hey, are you Sean?" "Absolutely. You must be the investigator from ST."
"Kinsey Milhone," I said. "Nice meeting you. I see I caught you hard at work."
"Always. I'm glad you figured out where I was.
The girl who came to the door told me you were back here."
"You met Memory."
"I assume so, though she didn't introduce herself."
His expression was wry.
"She sometimes comes up short in the manners department. Sorry about that. She doesn't mean to be rude."
"No need to apologize. You're the one I came to see."
"Hope I can help. How's Deborah doing these days?"
"Good. We did a beach walk last week, and she's in better shape than I am."
"Have a seat if you can find one," he said.
"This is fine."
He hoisted himself onto a bare patch of workbench while I leaned against the table, keeping us eye to eye. We chatted for a bit, working our way around to the subject at hand. Finally, he said, "Why don't you tell me what's going on?"
"I'll try to be succinct about this," I said.
I launched into my tale, distilling it down to the salient points. "An old kidnapping case has popped into view again, for reasons too complicated to go into. A little girl named Mary Claire Fitzhugh disappeared in July of 1967 and hasn't been seen since."
"That's bad."
"Very bad. But at least there's hope we'll find out what happened to the child. As I understand it, you and your mom and dad were in Santa Teresa that same summer."
"Greg wasn't my dad," he said. "Just want to be clear on that, since Mom was."
"Sorry, I'm hazy on the details, which is why I'm here."
"Matters not. Go on."
"I know the three of you were staying with the UNRWAs. Deborah tells me Greg was pressing them to hand over the money his grandfather had left him so he and Shelley could buy a farm."
Sean was already shaking his head.
"I heard him cooking up the story. But it was fiction, every word of it. Nitwits. I don't know what they were thinking. Patrick wasn't going to underwrite their cockamamie plan, even if it had been legitimate. The money was in trust, and there was no way they could have busted into it. Well, maybe with a legal hassle. But Greg wasn't in a position to stick around for that."
"What was he up to? Can you fill me in?"
"Sure. Greg dropped out of Berkeley in his sophomore year, which meant he lost his 2S student deferment and was reclassified as 1A, ready for immediate induction. His draft notice caught up with him, and he promptly burned it. He and Mom were both paranoid about authority, her more than him. He decided to go to Canada. She wasn't keen on the idea. But he had friends in hiding up there, and he figured he could take advantage of the connections. If he got his hands on his inheritance, they'd have enough to live on while they applied for citizenship."
"I can understand the kind of pressure he was under."
"Well, yeah, from his perspective. I'll tell you what was dumb. I didn't realize this until later, but in July of 67, Greg was 25 years old. Once he turned 26, he'd be off the hook. So all he had to do was wait. I don't think they were taking married guys. So if he and Mom had been willing to go that far, he'd have been home free. Not that they'd have done anything so pedestrian. They were hippies and way too free-spirited for anything as mundane as a civil ceremony. Anyway, once it was obvious the UNRWAs weren't going to cooperate, we hit the road, which was their solution to just about anything."
"Why such an abrupt departure?"
"They did everything on impulse, though there might have been something more going on. I heard a lot of heated whispers from the back of the bus. Greg was in a panic."
"Any idea when that was?"
"Not a clue.
I was a kid. What did I know?
I remember Mom lobbied hard for San Francisco. There was all this talk about the summer of love, and she was pissed she'd be missing out. She said it wasn't like they'd have a posse on their tails. There were thousands of guys ducking the draft, so all they had to do was keep on the move and they'd be fine. Cut no ice with Greg. He was anxious to get out of Dodge, so to speak. As far as she was concerned, that was his problem, not hers. She knuckled under in the end, but not without a lot of knockdown, drag-out fights. You want my take on it? I got the impression somebody called the draft board and dimed him out. If they left empty-handed, what did they do for money? The usual. Panhandled, sold dope, stole stuff. It's what they always did when they were down and out, which I might add was their permanent state. The trip took weeks because of all the stops we made, scoring cash for gas and food. To this day, I bet I could support myself standing at a four-way stop with a funky cardboard sign. They didn't turn around and head back to Santa Teresa for any reason. No way. Greg was freaked out. They were happy to be gone. Patrick believed they'd come up with a scheme to get money. He was convinced they never really left town. Sean shook his head. I'm the only one who ever came back, and that was 3 years ago when I read about Patrick being killed. I wanted to pay my respects. Are you aware that Rain was kidnapped right about the time Greg and Shelley left? Rain was? Less than a week after they took off. The ransom demand was 15 grand, which Patrick paid. She was returned in good shape, and 10 days later, the other little girl was snatched. The UNRWAs thought Greg and Shelley had a hand in it. Not true. Once we left the States, that was it. Why would Patrick blame them? Because it made sense. At least in his mind. The two were desperate for money. The UNRWAs refused, and the next thing they knew, Rain was abducted, and they were forced to pay. The plan was lame. But Deborah says their brains were addled from all the dope they smoked. Wow. That's a fact. I was stoned half the time myself. At 10? That's what life was like in those days. Don't get me wrong. Mom had her principles. Until I turned 16, she wouldn't condone peyote, cocaine, or heroin. She also drew the line at LSD. Very strict she was. She got into the heavy stuff herself, but not until later. You were homeschooled? That was her claim, but it was BS. She quit school when she was 15 and pregnant with me. That was 9th grade, so she didn't know enough to teach me anything. I survived by looking after myself. If I'd been a pain in the ass, she'd have dumped me the way she did Rain. When did you last see your mom? She died of AIDS in 86. Ugly business. I could have done without that. What about Greg? He died of an overdose when I was 14. That's when Mom and I came back to the States. Mom's first thought was San Francisco. Man, she was really burning up the road. Of course, the hate was dead by then, but she was ever hopeful. We lived in Berkeley for a while and then Santa Cruz. 8 months in Mexico, and I can't remember where else. We didn't stay long in any one place. It was a crappy way to grow up. How'd you end up in Belicia? It was one of our many stops along the way. I met a guy here who handcrafted furniture, and he said he'd mentor me if I was ever interested. By the time I was 20, I'd had it with all the moving around, so I settled here. He taught me everything I know. It looks like you're doing well. This is true, he said with mock modesty. How long have you and Memory been together? He smiled. She's not my girlfriend. I'm sorry, I just assumed. She's my sister. Really? I'm not sure Deborah knows about that. No reason she would. We left Santa Teresa in July. Memory was born in Canada the next April. Greg was pissed about the whole deal. He said the last thing they needed was another mouth to feed. He wanted Mom to put the baby up for adoption, but she was having none of it. They went after that subject, hammer and tongs. He said since she'd dumped Rain, she could dump this one, too. Mom wouldn't budge. Personally, I don't believe the baby was his. Wow. Whose, then? Who knows? Anyway, if we've covered the subject, I'll get back to work.
Sure thing.
I may call you later if something new comes up, but for now I appreciate your time.
Do you mind if I tell Rain about Memory?
I'm sure she knows about you, but I'm guessing she'd want to hear about her sister.
Deborah, too.
You can tell them anything you like.
I'd love to see Rain if she ever has the inclination to come up.
Or maybe Memory and I will drive down.
If I talk to her, I'll tell her you said so.
Give both of them my love.
Driving south again, I had a lot on my mind. I was still mulling over the account Hale Brandenburg had given me about Grand. When it came to Greg and Shelley's departure, I confess I felt vindicated. They hadn't turned around at all, let alone snatched first Rain and then Mary Claire. I understood Deborah's reasoning, but the points she cited were circumstantial, a crude cause and effect that didn't hold up to scrutiny. This was the kicker from my perspective. If Greg and Shelley weren't guilty, then who was? When I reached the office, I parked, snagged my shoulder bag, and got out of the car, locking it behind me. I noticed a car parked directly across from mine, a sleek white Corvette with a woman in the driver's seat and a guy in the passenger seat next to her. The sun reflecting off the windshield prevented a clear view of the driver, so I shrugged to myself and continued up the walk. I unlocked the office door, and as I was letting myself in, I heard two car doors slam in quick succession. I glanced over my shoulder and saw Diana Alvarez moving in my direction. Her male companion was someone I'd never seen before. Oh, joy, I thought. She looked as buttoned down as ever. Loafers, black tights, and a black corduroy jumper worn over a white turtleneck. I could see that any outfit looked spiffier when paired with black tights, and I vowed to add more to my wardrobe. Since I was already the proud owner of two skirts, I'd be all set. Diana carried a large leather tote, bulging from the weight of an oversized book. "I'm glad we caught you," she said. "We were just about to take off. This is my brother, Ryan." Belatedly, I saw the resemblance. The solemn, dark eyes were clearly a family trait. "Nice to meet you," I said. Ryan and I shook hands. He wore gray slacks and a charcoal sport coat over a pinstriped dress shirt. His red tie introduced the only note of color. Offhand, I pegged him as a salesman working in the retail clothing business, maybe Sears. I couldn't imagine why she was back again.
"Mind if we come in?" she asked.
"Might as well." I stepped back and let them move into the office ahead of me. They settled into the guest chairs, Diana adjusting her skirt before she placed her tote on the floor. She tilted the case against the modesty panel on the front of my desk. There was something self-satisfied in her demeanor, a quality I'd seen before and one that made me testy. I sat down in my swivel chair. "What can I do for you?" Even before she spoke, I could tell she'd rehearsed her remarks, eager to present herself as someone organized and in control. I told Ryan about the conversation we had. I interrupted, hoping to throw her off balance. "We've actually talked twice, once at the dig and again the next day. I'm referring to our meeting here. Something nagged at me when you talked about Michael seeing the two men in Horton Ravine. If you'll remember, I asked you then what made him so certain of the date, and you told me it was because it happened on his 6th birthday."
"Okay."
Even at the time, it seemed off. I remember saying so. "You know, you really don't have to go through the whole thing again." "I'm touching on the salient points," she said. "I hope you don't object."
"Far from it.
I'm begging you to get on with it. I've got work to do." She ignored that and went on. I half expected her to whip out her little spiral-bound notebook, but she'd committed her recital to memory. "You told me Mary Claire Fitzhugh was kidnapped on Wednesday, July 19th, 1967.
Michael claims he saw the two men 2 days later on Friday, the 21st. I waved a hand in the air, dismissing the details, which I didn't feel bore repeating. As far as I knew, none of this was in dispute. She shot me a dark look and then went on. According to his account, Mom dropped him off at the Kirkendalls. Billy was sick, so his mother let Michael wander on the property, and that's when he came across the two men. I'm repeating this for Ryan's sake, since he was the one who pointed out Michael's error. The error? A whopper, Ryan said. And what might that be? Diana reached for her tote and removed what I could see then was a scrapbook. The pages thick with newspaper clippings, programs, souvenirs, and party favors, some of which were sticking out. The assemblage was clearly the work of someone suffering from obsessive-compulsive disorder, who couldn't bear to throw anything away. She'd marked a particular page and she turned to it, reversing the album so I could see the contents without craning my neck. Looking down, she said, "I started this when I was 8. To remind you of the family order, by the time Michael turned 6, David was 10 years old, Ryan was 12, and I was 14. I'm aware of that, I said. I could see she was stringing it out, and I could hardly keep from rolling my eyes. I can assure you, you're unaware of this, she said. To celebrate his birthday that year, Mom and Dad took us all to Disneyland. You can see for yourself. She pointed to a photograph that showed a costumed Mickey Mouse and Cinderella in the background. All 4 kids were seated at a table in an outdoor cafe, leaning toward the center so the photographer could get them all in one shot. Michael and his siblings wore paper hats, all of them grinning for the camera. The paper tablecloth, napkins, and cups were decorated with happy birthday greetings in several different fonts. The birthday cake was at Michael's place, with 6 candles burning away merrily. I nearly said, "So what?" I was thinking, shit, a birthday doesn't have to be celebrated on the actual day. Parents can throw a party anytime they please. Diana sensed my response and moved her finger to the date and time stamp along the bottom of the photograph. 7/21/1967, 1 p.m. You might note these as well if you're not convinced. She turned the pages for me like a teacher reading a picture book upside down, so I'd have it in perspective. She'd pasted in dated programs, ticket stubs, receipts, and additional snapshots that showed the kids on a variety of rides. Every item that bore a date supported her claim. Ryan spoke up as though on cue. "There's something else." "I can hardly wait." "It's about the Kirkendalls." He was hoping I'd prompt him, but I was tired of their routine. I said nothing, forcing him to flounder on without an assist. He cleared his throat and coughed once, saying, "Sorry." Keith Kirkendall was a CPA who embezzled $1.5 million from the firm he worked for. The discrepancy showed up during an independent audit, and the authorities were closing in. He took his family and vanished overnight. So I've heard. Good. Then I'll get to the point. By July 17th, when the news of Kirkendall's crime appeared in the local paper, the family was gone. On Friday the 21st, the house was empty and not a stick of furniture remained. Even if Michael hadn't been at Disneyland, he couldn't have been there. I was silent for a moment, calculating rapidly. Maybe it was the week before. July 14th instead of the 21st. I was talking off the top of my head, desperate to salvage the story Michael had told me with such conviction. Diana wagged an index finger. "No, no, no," she said, as though correcting an errant child. "Mary Claire was kidnapped on the 19th. If Michael had seen the men the week before, even if he was correct about what they were up to, the bundle couldn't have been her. She was still alive and well." I closed my mouth and stared at them. Diana Alvarez's eyes were bright with triumph. I could feel the color rising in my cheeks. Offhand, except for an incident in first grade, I couldn't think when I'd felt so humiliated. I'd believed Sutton. I'd persuaded others he was telling the truth. Now, here I sat, feeling like an ass. I didn't care that my ego had taken a hit. I cared because we were back to square one where Mary Claire was concerned. The link, as tenuous as it might have been, was gone. Diana reached into her tote again, this time pulling out a file folder that she pushed across the desk. I made copies of the photographs from Disneyland. I also made copies of the clippings about Keith Kirkendall so you can read them at your leisure. I know you wouldn't be content to take our word for it. I pushed the folder back across the desk. I appreciate the offer, but you'll want those for your latest scrapbook. She left the folder where it was. I made duplicates. That's yours to keep. We've already dropped off a set for Lieutenant Phillips. Ryan fixed his big brown eyes on me with a phony look of pity and regret. Briefly, I considered leaping across the desk and biting him until he bled. "Sorry you had to go through this," he said. "It's typical of Michael, but that doesn't make it any less infuriating." "Have you told him?" Diana said. "No. As you know, we're not on the best of terms. We thought the blow might be softer if it came from you. In other words, you want me to stick it to him instead of you." Ryan said, "There's nothing personal at stake. We're setting the record straight. If you want us to put copies in the mail to him, we will. I'll take care of it." He reached into the inner pocket of his sport coat and took out a checkbook and pen. "We're assuming he didn't have the money to pay for your services." "Which is another reason we're here," Diana said. "I have no idea how much time and energy you've devoted to this wild goose chase, but we're prepared to cover what he owes." Ryan leaned forward to use the desk in writing the check. "Michael's paid in full." Diana's smile flickered. "Really? I find that hard to believe." "Life is a barrel of surprises, Diana. Was there anything else?" Ryan put the checkbook away, and the two exchanged a look, apparently at a loss as to what should come next. They'd probably hoped to hear me rage about Michael and his tenuous hold on the truth, but I'd have cut my own throat before I gave them the satisfaction. Their departure was awkward, hard-pressed as they were to detach themselves with any ease or grace. I didn't offer to escort them to the door, but I did trail after them without the usual end-of-meeting pleasantries. Once they were gone, I locked the door and returned to my desk, where I sat and stewed for the better part of an hour. Chapter 27. John Corso, June 1967. A week after the family left for Europe, John arrived at Walker's house on his scooter, just as Walker was coming down the drive in the second-hand 1963 Buick Skylark his father had given him the day he was accepted at UCST. The car wasn't new, but it was better than the crummy Chevrolet Lionel had bought for John. Walker leaned across the passenger seat and rolled down the window. "I gotta make a run. Leave the scooter in the carport and hop in." John walked his scooter up the incline, parked it, and then hustled down the driveway to the street where Walker was waiting. He got in on the passenger side and slammed the door.
"Where to?"
"Alita Lane. You won't believe this pair. They're living in a school bus. Creed and Destiny. He's an asshole, but she's a trip. They went over to the high school hoping to score some dope, and Chapman turned them on to me. Good deal." When they reached Alita Lane, Walker parked around the corner, and the two hoofed it back. Walker was careful to avoid parent types when delivering weed. He mentioned, in passing, that the house belonged to Creed's parents, Deborah and Patrick Unruh, whom John knew distantly from the country club. Mona was particularly enamored of Deborah Unruh, took every opportunity to fawn over her. Immediately, John anticipated the moment when he could casually refer to the time he'd spent at Deborah's. Soon afterward, however, he decided the connection would never pass his lips. There were things Mona wasn't meant to know, and most began to unfold on that day. John followed Walker around the side of the house to the cabana in back, where the school bus was parked. A boy of 10 or so was splashing naked in the pool, probably peeing in the water when it suited him. The school bus was ratty on the outside, but when John finally saw the interior, he thought it was cool. Decked out with mattresses, a camp stove, storage boxes. An Indian print spread served as a privacy screen, dividing the vehicle into two parts. The couple crashed in the back while the kids sacked out in the futon in front. The bus doors were open and the boyfriend was fussing around with something inside. The chick was cross-legged in the grass, knotting a length of hemp, using hitches and half-hitches to make a wall hanging or something equally useless, since the bus had no walls to speak of. She looked up as they approached. "Hey, Creed, we have company." Creed emerged from the bus, and Walker made the introductions. Nobody bothered to shake hands. Even years later, it was odd how vivid the moment seemed. Destiny was in her mid-20s, 6 or 7 years older than he. He'd never encountered anyone as hang loose as she was. Her nails were bitten to the quick. Her hair was a mass of curls. Her earrings were big silver hoops. She wore a scoop-necked peasant blouse, a long skirt, and Birkenstocks. She was chunky and smelled sooty from all the dope and cigarettes she smoked, but the scent reminded him of his mother. Destiny was a walking warning about the health hazards of poor nutrition and substance abuse. Within minutes, she mentioned she wasn't married to Creed. John said, "Is that your kid in the pool?" She laughed. "Mine, but not his. Skydancer's dad could have been any one of half a dozen guys." Was she for real? John couldn't believe she'd said that. After the preliminary chit-chat, Creed handed Walker a wad of wrinkled bills in exchange for a lid. Destiny set aside her macrame and invited them to partake, as she referred to it, and then proceeded to roll the tightest joint he'd ever seen, about the size of a bobby pin. The four of them settled on the mattress at the back of the bus, smoking and making idle conversation. She had a husky laugh, and she peppered the conversation with the sorts of expletives he associated with guys. After a time, he became aware that she was watching him. Creed, while dim, had to be aware of it, but seemed unconcerned. Smoking dope made John paranoid, and he was anxious about the kid who'd been left to play in the pool unsupervised. Now and then he'd find a pretext to hop out of the bus so he could check up on him. It wasn't his responsibility, but the kid's mother didn't seem to care. At one point, while he was paddling around the shallow end, she reappeared at John's side, managing to stand closer than the situation required. The heat pouring off her skin left John mute. When she spoke, angling her face to his, it reminded him of those movie moments when the lovers are on the verge of kissing. Why was she coming on to him with Creed no more than 15 feet away? John shifted his focus to the kid, who was doing cannonballs off the side of the pool, plumes of water splashing up. "Hey, Skydancer, shit for brains," she snapped. "What's the matter with you? You want to hit your head and drown? Get over here before you crack your skull and die." The kid grabbed the side of the pool and worked his way around to her. She leaned down and hauled him out by one arm, after which he sat, hunched and shivering, on the side. John peered at her. "What's his name?" "Skydancer. It's like his spiritual designation, the same way Destiny's mine." "Why? You think it's weird?" "It's not that. I just wasn't sure what you said." She made a remark half under her breath, and then turned to him,
waiting for a response.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, you did, she said with a slow smile. He stared at her for a moment and then made an excuse and returned to the bus. What kind of game was she playing? From that day on, he and Walker hung out with Creed and Destiny most afternoons. In her company, John was detached, seldom making eye contact. Surreptitiously, he studied her, noting her gestures, absorbing her raucous laugh and her air of confidence. She didn't shave her legs or armpits, and she exuded an animal smell that stirred him in some curious way. She'd taken to ignoring him, but he knew she was as aware of him as he was of her. She was the antithesis of the Playboy centerfolds, and he wove her into his daydreams. On the occasions when Walker had other deliveries to make, John rode over on his scooter so he'd have his own transportation. Later, he couldn't remember how the discussion about the money came up. Walker arrived 15 or 20 minutes after he did that day. The three of them, John, Creed, and Destiny, were sitting around smoking dope as usual, while Creed bitched and whined about his parents. Walker stretched out on the mattress, toking on the joint when it came around to him. John sent Walker a look and then turned to Creed, saying, "Start over and tell him. Walker's big on finance." Creed said, "Like I was telling John before you got here, my grandfather left me money in his will, and my parents are refusing to let me have it. They claim I can't collect until I'm 30. How fucked up is that?" Destiny said, "His dad is such a butt. Creed's entitled to the money. So what gives him a say in the matter one way or the other?" "How much are we talking about?" Walker asked. John said, $40,000. Walker said, "Groovy. So, what's the deal? Was it left in trust?" "Technically. But that's bullshit. Dad could fork it over. He's got money up the wazoo." "What do you need $40,000 for? You planning a cruise?" John asked, his tone mild. Creed and Destiny exchanged a look, and Creed said, "We're buying a farm. We put $1,000 down, and we need the rest by the end of the month." John laughed. "A farm? You're shitting me." Creed scowled. "What's wrong with that? We're planning to work the land, raise chickens and goats and sheep and like that," Destiny said. "I'll learn to make cheese, and I can sell my macrame. We'll be completely self-sufficient. It'll be way cool." "You're not buying a farm," John said. "What the hell are you talking about? How do you propose to work the land when you don't know jack shit about anything?" He developed a very low opinion of Creed and loved egging him on. Sometimes Destiny sided with her boyfriend, and sometimes she turned on him, mocking him as John did. Today, she was standing by her man. She said, "We're talking about a commune, dickwad. Don't be such a prick. Everyone will pitch in." John could barely suppress a smile. "Oh, excuse me. A commune. Well, that explains it." Destiny bristled. "God, John, who the fuck asked you? Why are you always trying to bring us down? Keep your opinions to yourself." "Hey, Des, come on. Why not tell them the truth?" Creed said. "Because it's none of their business." "What isn't?" Walker asked. "Nothing. Just drop it," she said. Creed ignored her. "We're immigrating."
"Knock it off, Creed. You've said enough."
"Where to?" John asked.
"Canada."
Destiny pushed Creed sideways.
"You know what your problem is? You don't know how to keep your big mouth shut." "Baby, cool it. Would you just cool it? These are friends of ours, okay?"
Creed turned to John. "I got my draft notice 3 weeks ago. We were having mail forwarded to a post office box in Oakland, and there it was. I knew it was only a matter of time before they caught up with me. Short of shooting off my toe or claiming to be a bedwetter, my proverbial ass is grass. I'm cannon fodder, big time, Walker said. So you're heading to Canada? Far out. I thought Sweden was the haven of choice, John remarked. Nah, Canada's easier. We take the old yellow school bus and head north. We don't even need passports. The 40s to cover us while we apply for citizenship, she added. John's gaze shifted to her. What if you get caught? Destiny flashed a look at him. Man, you are bumming me out. What's all the negativity about? I'm getting bad vibes from you. I'm not putting you down. I'm just asking what you'll do if they catch up with you, he said. We don't need your counsel, shitbird. You're 18 years old. You think Creed's mom and dad are going to buy your cock and bull story about a farm? That's it, John. You're out of here. We don't have to put up with your shit, she said. He smiled. So, okay, ignore me. But I'm telling you the truth. Creed's parents aren't stupid. You talk about starting a commune, they'll laugh in your face. Creed said, they already did when we first brought it up. You won't get a cent unless you come up with something better than that. Maybe we have. We've been giving it some thought. Creed? What's wrong with running it by them? Great. And have them rat us out. That'll be a big help. Irritated, Walker said, get off it. We're not snitches. I'll just bet. John watched her with interest. Now you got me curious. Creed took two quick hits from the joint and passed it to John. Destiny came up with this. We could make it look like Rain's been abducted and someone's holding her for ransom. Dad would fall all over himself forking up the dough. So how much ransom? 40,000? That'll fool 'em, John said. Destiny said, shit, John, would you lighten up? We're still working out the details, okay? We're tossing ideas around. We figure she's our kid, so it's not like we're really doing any harm. John drew on the joint, making the tip glow a bright red before he passed it on to her. I thought his folks adopted her. Technically, sure, but she's still our kid, she said. Creed said, yeah, John, you're missing the point. We scare him shitless, wait a couple of days, and then hit him good like it's a one-time deal. Pay, and you get the kid back. You don't pay, she's dead. They'll come through in a heartbeat, no questions asked. Destiny brightened, warming to the subject. It'll look like someone snatched her, only she won't be in danger. Well, that sucks right there, John said. Jesus. Don't look at me like that. I'm playing devil's advocate. What if they call the cops or the FBI? I sure as shit would. You'll have the law swarming all over you. Not if we set it up right. Which would be what? He asked. We're brainstorming. I'm not saying we've got all the answers, she said. You don't have any answers. Walker cut in. Where are you going to keep her? Destiny considered the issue and then shrugged. I don't know. Maybe a motel. Who's going to babysit the kid while the two of you walk around pretending to be innocent? Maybe we'll be gone by then. Then how would you collect the dough? We'd find a way, she said, irritated with his persistence. John said, why don't you do the obvious? Tell them you have her stashed somewhere and you won't turn her over unless they make it worth your while. They don't pony up, they'll never see her again. I don't think my dad would go for it, Creed said. So far, he's turned us down cold. Don't ask for 40. Ask for 15. That's enough to get you out of the country. Yeah, but what if they balk, she asked. I mean, what if they tell us to take her and shove off, then what? Then I guess you get your daughter back, John said. It was the weekend after that that their relationship changed. The last 2 weeks of June, Walker went to Hawaii on vacation with his folks. With Walker gone, John was at loose ends. The first couple of days he hung out at his place, watching TV. On day 3, he decided it was time to get out. He fired up his scooter and headed over to the UNRWA's, arriving just in time to see the family pulling out of the drive. Looked like Patrick at the wheel, Deborah in the front seat, and Creed, Rain, and Skydancer in the back. He wasn't sure if Destiny was with them or not. He parked the scooter and then peeked in the yellow school bus, which was empty. He could see her half-finished macrame lying in the grass. "Hey, Destiny? You here?" No response. He shrugged and circled the house to the cabana, surprised at the pang of disappointment that shot through him. "Is that you, John?" He followed the sound of her voice and found her sitting on the edge of the pool, her gypsy skirt pulled up around her as she dangled her legs in the water. She wore a tank top, a white one, and he could see the freckles that covered her shoulders and chest. "Sun damage," she said when she caught his look. "Where'd everybody go? I saw Creed and his folks in the car with the kids." "It's Skydancer's birthday, and he asked if he could go to the band concert in the pocket park on the hill. Deborah packed a picnic lunch. They'll be gone for hours." "Why didn't you go?"
"Because I was hoping to see you." "You want to see me?"
She lifted her skirt, showing him that she was naked from the waist down. She opened her legs, exposing herself. Irritably, John said, "What's the matter with you? Would you cut that out?" She laughed. "Don't be a stick in the mud. It's just us." He scanned the surroundings, realizing how sheltered the area was from the eyes of neighbors. The trellised fencing that stretched out on each side of the cabana was overgrown with wisteria that obstructed the view into the UNRWA's backyard. "This is a very bad idea," he said.
"I think it's a very good idea."
He put his hands in his pockets, his gaze restlessly searching the perimeter of the property. The air was hot and he could hear birds. Two houses away, a lawnmower buzzed, and even at that remove, he could smell the cut grass. She ran her hands down along her belly and between her legs.
"What would you give for a piece of this?"
"I'm not going to pay you."
"I'm not talking about money, shithead. I'm talking about what it's worth to you."
"What about Creed?"
"We have an open relationship."
"He knows you're doing this?"
"He probably has a pretty good idea. As long as we don't rub his nose in it, so to speak, then what's it to him?
Creed doesn't own me, and I don't own him."
"Anyone could walk in," he said. "What if the mailman comes by or the UPS guy delivering a package?"
"If you're so worried about being seen, why don't we go into the cabana where we can talk and get to know each other a little bit?
If you feel uncomfortable, all you have to do is say so.
I'm not going to knock you down and jump your bones." She held a hand up, wanting him to pull her to her feet. John ignored her.
"You'd prefer to do it all out here?"
"No."
"Then help me up."
John grabbed her hand and pulled her to her feet. Primly, she shook her skirt down.
"All nice and neat," she said.
She moved toward the cabana. John followed her with a mounting sense of disbelief. This couldn't be happening. Passing through the door, she lifted her crossed arms and pulled the tank top over her head. Inside, she'd made a pallet of blankets. Two joints at the ready with a roach clip, a pack of matches, and an ashtray. She unbuttoned her skirt and stepped out of it. Her figure was womanly. Generous ass, small breasts with brown nipples as big and flat as 50-cent pieces. The thatch of hair between her legs was dark and bushy. She knelt on the blanket, picked up a joint, and lit it. She took two or three quick draws and held the smoke in. She closed her eyes and toked once more before releasing the smoke in a thin stream.
"You're wasting time, John. Don't just stand there with your clothes on. You can do better than that."
He hesitated, looking down at her as though measuring the drop from a 10-meter board. He stripped off his t-shirt and then stepped out of his pants. When he took off his jockey shorts, he saw the change come over her face. Oh, my God, you're beautiful. Incredible. I'd forgotten what 18 looks like. She crawled to the edge of the blanket and ran a hand along his bare flank, then looked up at him. He bent and kissed her upturned mouth. Chapter 28. Wednesday afternoon, April 20th, 1988. Wednesday afternoon, I took Cabana Boulevard up the hill to Seashore Park, a city-owned stretch of palm trees and grass that skirts the bluff overlooking the Pacific. That morning, I'd called Michael and asked him to meet me there. In my shoulder bag, I had the file folder of clippings about Keith Kirkendall and copies of the photographs his sister had given me the day before. My body hummed with dread, but there was no avoiding the conversation. I couldn't bear to lay the revelation at his feet, but there was no escape. The day was sunny and the air mild, with scarcely any breeze at all. While I waited, I walked the length of the chain-link fence that had been erected to prevent citizens from tumbling off the cliff. The drop to the ocean below was a good 60 feet. At high tide, the surf concealed the rocks. At low tide, the rocks were laid bare. Either way, a fall would be fatal. Looking down, I could see the telltale muddy plume where a sandbar had formed, and the waves were breaking differently than they did 100 yards on each side. Most people think of the effluence as a riptide, but the proper term is rip current. Tides are the function of the moon's gravitational pull. A rip current is a treacherous outflow that runs in a narrow line perpendicular to the beach, sometimes extending as far as 2,500 feet. The term undertow, used to describe the same phenomenon, is a misnomer as well. A rip current moves along the surface of the water, a function of the hidden shape of the shore itself. This one, like the rip current that swept Sutton's mother to her death, was an artifact of the same attempt by the city engineers to create a safe harbor where there was none before. As with so much in life, good intentions often generate unexpected results. I heard Sutton's MG approaching long before I saw him pull into the small parking lot. He had the top down, and his hair had been whipped into an untidy thatch that he smoothed as he stepped out of the car. He wore a sweatshirt and shorts. The sight of his knobby knees nearly broke my heart. As before, I was struck by his youthfulness. When he was 50 instead of 26, he'd look the same. I couldn't picture him portly or bald. I couldn't picture him with heavy jowls or a double chin. As he aged, his face would shrink away from his skull, but it would otherwise retain its boyish cast. On the phone, I hadn't specified the reason for the meeting. I felt badly about it now because he suspected nothing, which made him all the more vulnerable. Though I didn't understand the psychological dynamic, I sensed that after the destruction he'd brought down on his family, he'd moved from villainy to victimhood. By rights, the family should have been the ones to lay claim to all the suffering. Instead, the burden was his. There was a bench situated at the halfway point between us. As he approached from the narrow parking strip, I crossed the grass and sat down, placing the folder beside me, saying, "Hi, Michael. I appreciate your meeting me." He sat down. "I was going into town anyway, so it was easy enough to swing by." "How are you?" "Not bad," I said. "How's Madeline?" "Good. I'm on my way to pick her up, as a matter of fact." "Good? I heard she was arrested for public drunkenness." "She was. But the judge said he'd give her probation if she promised to straighten up her act." "I see. And what does that consist of?" "AA meetings twice a week. She doesn't have a car, so I take her over and pick her up afterward." "Has it occurred to you she's taking advantage of you?" This is just until she gets back on her feet. She's trying to find a job, but there's not a lot available in her field. Which is what? She's a model. And in the meantime, you provide meals, housing, transportation, bail money, and Goldie's dog food, right? She'd do the same for me. I'm not convinced of that, but let's hope. His smile faded. You don't seem happy with me. What's wrong? I don't even know where to start, I said. I blew out a big breath, marshaling my thoughts. Try as I might, I couldn't find a nice way of putting it. Yesterday, Ryan and Diana came to the office. She brought in a scrapbook that included memorabilia from your 6th birthday party. Memorabilia? Yeah, you know, snapshots, ticket stubs, stuff like that. Ticket stubs? What are you talking about? July 21st, you were all at Disneyland. Your mom and dad, Ryan, David, Diana, and you. I watched the animation draining out of his face. That can't be right. That was my first response. She's making things up, trying to get me in trouble. I indicated the folder on the bench. She made copies of the photographs, you can see for yourself. She's wrong. She has to be. I don't think so. She's a reporter. She may be irritating, but she knows how to write a story, and she knows she better get her facts straight. Take a look. I don't need to look. I was at Billy's house. My mother dropped me off. The Kirkendalls were gone by then. Billy's dad stole a shitload of money. You said so yourself. He knew the police were closing in on him, so he took his family and fled. The house was empty. You think I lied? I think you made a mistake. I saw the pirates that day. The two of them were digging a hole. It could have happened before we left for Disneyland. The timing is off. Whatever you saw, it must have been the week before. And as Diana so aptly pointed out, if you saw the guys on July 14th instead of July 21st, it couldn't have been Mary Claire's body wrapped for burial. She wasn't kidnapped until 5 days later. He stared off at the sky, rocking his body on the bench. It was the self-comforting motion of a kid whose mother's an hour late picking him up from nursery school. He was almost beyond hope. Look, Michael, no one's faulting you, I said. When dealing with someone else's emotional distress, it's best to gloss over the enormity of the disaster. It doesn't change reality, but it makes the moment easier, for the onlooker at any rate. Are you kidding? She must have had a good laugh at my expense. Ryan, too. They were always in cahoots. Shit. Now he'd turned it into a conspiracy. I kept my mouth shut. I'd already offered as much comfort as I could muster. What about Lieutenant Phillips? Does he know? I glanced away from him, which told him what he'd already guessed. She told him, too? Michael, don't do this. Yes, she told him. She had to. He was in on the story from the first. She gave him the same file folder she gave me, and so what? He blinked and put his right hand to his face, pulling down until his hand covered his mouth. I saw the pirates. They knew I'd caught them in the act. Okay, fine. But not when you thought you did. July 21st, 1967, you and your family were 100 miles away. They were burying a bundle. I believe you saw something, but it wasn't Mary Claire. He shook his head. No. They took the body somewhere else and put a dog in the hole. It was right where I showed you. Let's quit with the arguing and deal with what's true instead of what you dreamed up. He lifted a hand. Never mind. You're right. I wasted your time and I misled the police. Now all parties concerned are fully aware of it. So much for me and anything I might say. Would you stop that shit? I can't sit here and sympathize when you're wallowing in self-pity. I understand your embarrassment, but take your licks and move on. He got up abruptly and walked away. Watching him, I could see how he wanted the scene to play out. My role was to hurry after him, offering him reassurances. I was supposed to fling myself into the conflict to help him save face. I couldn't do it. The bottom had dropped out. The search for Mary Claire was over, and he knew it as well as I did. She might be buried somewhere, but it had nothing to do with him. While I understood his humiliation, his behavior was calculated to generate a response. He was the vacuum. I was meant to be the air rushing in to fill the space. Stubbornly, I stayed where I was. I heard the car door slam. The engine roared to life. I looked over and watched him back out in a wide arc before he threw the car in first and drove off with a chirp of his tires. To no one in particular, I said, "Sorry about that. I wish I could help you, but I can't." I picked up the folder and returned to my car. I slid under the wheel and sat for a moment, watching pigeons pecking in the grass. I was only 5 blocks from home, and my instinct was to run for cover. What I was facing wasn't new. Past investigations had occasionally come apart in my hands, and I hadn't felt the need to fall on my sword. I'm an optimist. I operate on the assumption that if a question is legitimate, there's an answer out there, which is no guarantee I'll be the one to find it. While the current failing wasn't mine, I couldn't shake the sense that I'd messed up somehow. It was mid-afternoon, and I probably could have talked myself into quitting for the day, but one can only do that so often before it becomes habitual, and therefore unprofessional. Playing hooky wasn't the antidote to disappointment. Work was. I had a business to run, and I needed to get back to it. Easier said than done. When I reached the office, I set up a pot of coffee, and then I sat at my desk and did nothing. I'd chastised Sutton for feeling sorry for himself, but it wasn't such a bad idea. When you've been dealt a blow, self-pity, like rationalization, is just another way of coping with the pain. A sound penetrated my consciousness, and I realized someone was tapping on one of the panes in my outer office door. I glanced at my calendar. I wasn't expecting anyone, and there was no note of an appointment. For a moment, I had the bizarre sense of skipping back in time. I pictured myself getting up to look around the corner at the front door. Through the glass, I'd catch my first sight of Michael Sutton. It would be April 6th again, and I'd be forced to relive the same series of events. I left my desk and crossed to the inner office door, where I peered into the reception area. There was a woman on my doorstep, pointing at the knob. For the second time in 2 weeks, I'd locked up automatically after letting myself in. I turned the deadbolt and opened the door. "Sorry about that. Can I help you?" "I wondered if I might talk to you." "Sure, I'm Kinsey Milhone. Have we met?" "Not really. I'm Joanne Fitzhugh, Mary Claire's mother. May I come in?"
"Of course."
I stepped aside as though admitting an apparition. She was probably in her mid-50s with one of those lovely, mild faces assigned to dead saints on Catholic calendars. She was half a head shorter than I, with shoulder-length blonde hair worn in the sort of flip I'd longed for in high school. She wore a dark skirt and a matching cropped jacket, with a green silk blouse under it. For someone I'd thought about so often, I was unprepared for an encounter. What was I going to say to her? I'd come up against a blank wall. How could I explain where I'd started and where I'd ended up? "Would you like a cup of coffee?" "I'm fine. Don't worry about it." She sat down in one of the guest chairs and pulled the other one closer, giving the seat a quick pat as a way of encouraging me to sit near her instead of on the other side of the desk. She was clearly in charge. When I settled in the chair, the two of us were almost knee to knee. Her features were finely drawn, small blue eyes, light brows and lashes, a straight nose and lips thinned by age. Usually, I think of beautiful women in terms of the overblown. High cheekbones, big eyes, plump lips. Hers was a beauty of a different kind. Soft, subdued. Her cologne smelled like fresh soap. And if she wore makeup at all, it was discreetly applied. I can't make small talk with someone whose only child has been kidnapped and killed. So, I left it up to her. I spoke to Lieutenant Dolan this morning. He's been gracious about keeping in touch with me since he retired. He called, saying your name had come up with regard to Mary Claire's disappearance. He tells me a young man named Michael Sutton has come forward with information that looks promising. I don't know what to say. May I call you Joanne?
Of course.
Michael was wrong about the date. This came to light yesterday, and I'm still adjusting to the disappointment. He was a kid at the time, 6 years old, and the incident he remembered actually happened a week earlier, if at all.
I don't understand.
Lieutenant Dolan said he came across two men digging what appeared to be a grave 2 days after Mary Claire was kidnapped.
You're saying his report was false?
He made a mistake. There was no malice intended. He read a newspaper article, and Mary Claire's name triggered a vivid recollection. His story sounded reasonable. Detective Phillips thought it was worth pursuing, and so did I. Yesterday, Michael's sister came in with evidence showing he wasn't anywhere near Santa Teresa on the date he claimed. So it looks like he conjured the memory out of whole cloth. Whatever he saw, it had nothing to do with Mary Claire. I wish we had more, but it's not there.
Well, she stared down at her hands.
I know this is hard on you, and I'm sorry.
Not your fault? I should be used to it by now.
I should have detached years ago, but I've never found a way to do it. Something like this comes up. A scrap of information surfaces, and even against my better judgment, I feel a flutter of hope. I can't tell you how many people have come up with clues in the last 20 years. They write, they call, they stop me on the street. All of them claiming to know Mary Claire's whereabouts. Any reference in the paper and the tips come pouring out. Some ask for money, and some just want to feel important, I suppose. Believe me, Michael wasn't doing this for gain. He was hesitant about going to the police and uneasy when they sent him over to me. As odd as his story was, it seemed to hold an element of truth. In the end, it just didn't hang together. I'm not blaming anyone. It's all just so endless. Look, I know this is none of my business, but can you tell me what happened afterward? I can't imagine what it must have done to your personal life.
It's simple enough.
My husband and I divorced. It might have been unfair to fault Barry for the way he handled the situation, but watching him those 3 days taught me things I hadn't fully understood. He took over. He called all the shots. I was relegated to the sidelines while he dealt with the police and the FBI. My opinions and my reactions meant nothing to him. For the first time, I saw the sort of man I was married to.
What would you have done if it had been up to you?
Exactly what they asked. I'd have kept the matter quiet instead of bringing in the police. I'd have paid the ransom without a second thought. That's what the Unruhs did, and their daughter survived. I'm sure the FBI would have deemed it the worst possible tactic, but what did they have at stake? $25,000 was nothing to us. I found out later Barry had twice that much in a secret account, money he used to establish his new life after we separated. For all I know, that was always his intention, saving up so he could leave. I reached a point where I didn't care one way or the other. I suppose if Mary Claire had been saved, if she'd come back to us alive, we might have smoothed things over and gone on as we had before.
Is he still in town?
He moved to Maine. I think he wanted a location as unlike California as he could find. He remarried and started another family. So much for us. Do you have any idea why you were targeted? Barry owns a wealth management firm. It's a company he started years ago, and he's always done well. He felt that's what put us in the line of fire. That, and because Mary Claire was an only child. How long were you married? 8.5 years. She hesitated. I'll admit, when he left me, I took revenge. Spiteful little thing that I am. According to our prenuptial agreement, if we divorced, he'd have paid me a pittance in alimony for the next 10 years. He was older. He'd been married twice before. I knew the risk I was taking, and I did what I could to protect myself, though it didn't amount to much. When our relationship collapsed, he was hoping for a quick divorce, so he'd be off the hook. My attorney argued the prenup should be set aside because I'd signed under duress. By the time the divorce became final, he'd been forced to settle for $6 million plus $1 million in legal fees. So, here we are. He's stuck with me for life, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health. Do you work? I don't have a job, if that's what you're referring to. I'm a part-time docent at the art museum, and I volunteer 2 mornings a week at Santa Teresa Hospital in the newborn nursery. Is there any chance your daughter had medical problems? Allergies, asthma, anything like that? I'm trying to understand what might have happened to her. She'd had the occasional seizure since infancy, and the pediatrician had her on Dilantin. I take it you ask because you think something might have gone wrong. Exactly. I don't believe those guys were hardened criminals. Rain tells me she was treated well. She believes they mixed sleeping pills in her lemonade. But instead of going down for the count, she got hyper and slept less and less. Suppose they upped the dose, trying to induce sleep. If Mary Claire was already on an anticonvulsant, the combination of medications might have been fatal. I see what you're saying, and it makes sense. My poor little one, she said. She covered her eyes for a moment as though she might block out the very idea. I watched her work to compose herself, and she finally sighed. What now? Is this as far as it goes? I don't know what to tell you. I'm fresh out of Leeds. On the other hand, I can't quite let go. I don't like feeling I haven't done my job right. She leaned forward and put her hands over mine. Please don't give up. One of the reasons I came here was to tell you how much I appreciate your efforts. Even if you're facing a blank wall, don't concede. Please. I'll do my best. I can't promise you anything beyond that. Chapter 29. Walker McNally. Wednesday afternoon, April 20th, 1988. Walker pushed his cuff back discreetly and checked the time. He'd stopped wearing the sling, and he was happy to have his right arm free. 7 minutes to go in yet another interminable AA meeting, this one sparsely attended, which made his unwillingness to share all the more conspicuous. Some of the regulars were there. An old geezer named Fritz was missing half his teeth. A woman who called herself Phoebe, though he could have sworn he'd been introduced to her at the club by another name. The only person in the room under 40 was a young, dark-haired girl, thin as a snake, her eyes lined in coal. Her nails were clipped short and painted dark red. She smoked and said nothing, which he personally applauded, as he intended to do the same. She looked like she was barely old enough to drink, and he wondered what had brought her to this sorry place. No sign of Avis Gent, which was a relief. He was 9 days sober, a miracle in itself. In the past, when he'd claimed he'd quit drinking, he'd never actually gone more than 2 days without alcohol of some kind. When the meeting ended, he bypassed the bad coffee and headed for the side door, trying not to appear too thrilled to escape. The girl was a few steps in front of him, and he flirted with the idea of making an offhand comment, something tongue-in-cheek to establish rapport. It would be nice to compare notes with someone in the same boat. He was beginning to understand why non-drinkers hung out together. Misery loves company. Outside, the afternoon sun was brighter than he expected, and he raised a hand to shade his eyes. It was close to 3, coming up on the treacherous 5-hour stretch between happy hour and lights out.